And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoy the episode.
We are commencing our discussions about Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, our reread of the second book. We just wanted to start at the top of the episode just saying thank you so much to everybody who's listened to the podcast so far. We record all of our episodes way in advance. We actually yesterday just released our first episode, and the reception has been great so far, and we're really appreciative to those who have tuned in.
Yeah, the funny thing is that Aaron and I are truly at the end of the day doing this for ourselves.
Sorry.
It's an ode to our friendship, but it's so exciting that we get to have so many new friends, old for some of us, but new for some of us, kind of come along this journey with us and listen along. And we're really glad that you guys seem to be liking the episode. And we hope you feel that we're approachable and fun, and that this is like a great place to check out of real life and come into the magical world for us for a little bit.
Correct. Yeah.
So just thank you guys so much. I've had so many friends and family members text me. I know Aaron's had the same thing and just have really liked it. So if you guys can continue listening, obviously, but also sharing to your friends and family, it's the best way to get our podcast out to a broader network. So we really appreciate you guys. Without further ado, we're kicking off Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. We've both reread chapters 1-5. That's what we're going to be starting with today. I have some fun facts about the book release.
Oh, please give me your fun facts.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets is the second novel in the series. It was released in 1998 in the UK and then a full year later in the US, which I thought was very interesting. I guess as the books become more popular, they're going to have one solid release date. Because I remember dressing up and going to the Deathly Hallows date at Barnes and Noble, and
so same.
I think it was like a worldwide release date, but at this time they had two release dates, one for the UK, one for the US. And
I have a question about that.
Yeah,
do you think that has to do with like the first book was received so well? Do you think they were maybe like testing the waters to see how the second book was going to fare before they decided how they were going to release it elsewhere?
I didn't read anything specific, but yeah, I would probably agree with that general sentiment that
yeah,
they were still feeling it out. And obviously the book was an even bigger hit in the UK, and
yeah,
it really kind of caught storm in the US. So I think they probably adjusted based on that. But what was also interesting to me is that the author, I think we're not going to use her name going forward in this
Love
book,
that.
The author found it difficult to finish the book and said that she felt that it was not going to be a good book. She wasn't very confident about it, but it was highly praised right from the gamut when it was released. Some other fun facts about The Chamber of Secrets is that out of all of the books in the series, all seven books, it triggered some of the most strong religious debates. And many religious authorities condemned the book and banned it. Just for the content, especially towards the end of the book, we're really probably not going to talk about that as much today because we're just in the first five chapters. But others pushed back against that, other reviewers, and praised the book for its themes of self-sacrifice and the way one's character is a result of one's choices. So sort of like an interesting across-the-board reaction to the book. And one of the things Aaron and I have planned is we'd like to have a professional come on and talk to us about if you can be Christian and like Harry Potter, because both Aaron and I are Christians and obviously in love with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And this book has a lot of very serious themes, especially around racism and classism. Most reviewers said that this book was praised as being appropriate for children and appropriate for adults, more so than the first book, which really primarily came out as a children's novel.
Mm-hmm.
One reviewer from the New York Times wrote that the conflict with Tom Riddle in the later portion of the book was scarier than some Stephen King novels.
Ooh, yeah.
Altogether, the book has sold to date 4.25 million copies.
Should we talk about chapter one?
Yeah, the worst birthday.
Oh,
I saw, maybe you posted it on our Instagram, but it was like a compilation of the worst reasons.
MuggleNet, also a fantastic Wizarding World platform. MuggleNet posted an IGTV video that was like ranking Harry Potter's birthdays, like from best to worst. It was really awesome. It was very funny. Good
and
job, MuggleNet.
Yesterday was Harry's 40th birthday. Also the author's birthday, but we're not celebrating.
We're not going to talk about that.
It's only Harry's birthday, which I'm going to say it's a little bit narcissistic to give your main character of your book the same birthday.
Can I say a fun thing about birthdays? Mm-hmm. I've recently realized that I share a birthday with Lily Potter. Like Lily Potter's canonical birthday is my birthday. My boyfriend's birthday is James Potter's canonical birthday, which, like, I don't know if that's a great sign or a horrible sign, but I just thought that was, of all the days, of all the two people that could have gotten together. Anyway.
So it's Harry's birthday, and this book has a really disappointing start because Harry, like, leaves on such a high note from Hogwarts in his first year. He's on the Quidditch team, and he's a Quidditch star. He has two awesome new best friends. He's just saved the school from Voldemort again.
For the first time at age 11. Oh, well, I guess again, if you're referring to when he was one, yes.
Yes.
But at age 11, he has saved the school from Voldemort.
Gryffindor's won the House Cup for the first time in, like, 11 years.
Which maybe was not super legit, but, you know, whatever.
Hey, Neville's points counted.
Oh, I fully count Neville's. They all count. Anyway.
So he leaves the school on such a high note, and then we get to the first chapter of this book, and it's like, oh, geez. Not much has changed for Harry in the Muggle world.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like, how do you return to a world where in one part of your life you are, like, a very well-known, famous, beloved figure in the community, and then you go back to a world where you are actively abused and disliked. Like, how do you return to that? That sucks.
And the Dursleys, they hate Harry more now than ever, because now he has a year of magic under his belt. And what I love is that he doesn't tell them that underage wizards are not supposed to be using magic.
That's what I was going to say. The only advantage that he has that entire summer is that the Dursleys have no, which is weird because you'd think Petunia would know. You'd think Petunia, from growing up with Lily, would know that Lily was not allowed to use magic when she was home for summer. But perhaps Lily sort of used the same tactic that Harry did and didn't tell her. So the one thing that Harry has on the Dursleys right now is that they don't know that he's not allowed to do magic outside of school as an underage wizard, which means they live in fear of getting hexed or given pigtails every minute.
I love, it's right on the second page, but Dudley tells Harry to pass the frying pan so he can get more bacon. And Harry says, "You've forgotten the magic word." And just the word magic sends the three of them into an uproar, and they're crashing chairs and they're falling off themselves. Like, it's so funny. And Vernon says, "I warned you, I will not tolerate mention of your abnormality under this roof."
My gosh, what a dried up old prune. The note that I have in my notebook for this chapter is, chapter one, recap for dummies who for some reason skipped the first book. Yeah, it's like we get an entire recap of Harry's first year, and I guess it's a good reminder, but also it's like there's so many details where I'm like, this is for people who did not know the order of the series and bought book two first.
Yeah. I would agree with that sentiment. So chapter one really is just a recap, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of course, it's his 12th birthday. Nobody has remembered it. And Vernon, Petunia, and Dudley are getting ready for a dinner party.
With Vernon's potential client, the Masons. Yeah, he's got a lot of career stuff riding on this interaction. And he's hoping to sell, Vernon sells drills. That's his profession, and he's hoping to sell a lot of drills to this man, and they're, I think it says somewhere that they're planning to use the money that they expect to get from the commission to buy a house in Mallorca.
Which, that confused me so much, because I wouldn't say the Dursleys are wealthy. I think they're like an average family, probably.
Financially secure middle class.
Yeah, they're upper middle class. That's what I would say. So I feel like that's a very big bump to go from a middle class family to buying a vacation home in a different country.
Yeah, so a lot of money must have been riding on this.
Yeah, exactly. But is that really what you would use that money for? They're rehearsing what they're going to say as the Masons come in. And Dudley's line is, I just had to write a report about my hero in school, and I chose you. Would that not creep you out?
He's really laying it on thick, isn't he?
The first time you've met this boy, and he's chosen, I mean, unless Mr. Mason is like a local celebrity.
Which he could be. But also, you know what? I think Vernon and Petunia sat sweet little Dudley down and said, listen, Dudley, if Daddy makes this deal go through next year for your birthday, you will get 80 presents instead of 30 or something. So like they had to have relayed this information in Dudley's language to get him to understand how important this is.
So they send Harry back up to his bedroom, and this is the first time we get to meet Dobby.
I love Dobby's definitely an Enneagram 2, okay?
Oh, for sure.
He's like a chaotic Enneagram 2. One of the things Dobby says to Harry that I just adore, and I think it's on, I want to say page 15, Dobby says, Dobby has heard of your greatness, sir, but of your goodness, Dobby never knew, which is just another confirmation that Harry has a good heart and good character, even as a child.
I have to say, as much as I am going to grow to love Dobby, I very much dislike Dobby in the early parts of this book.
Well, we don't really know what is happening. We're like, what is a house elf? What is he doing here?
He's a hurricane. He just comes in and just messes little everything up.
Tiny, squeaky hurricane.
Oh, gosh. It gave me so much anxiety reading this chapter.
Dobby definitely has the most chaotic energy of anybody in this book.
Like 27 5-hour energies.
Yeah.
He was like ready to go.
To Harry, Dobby is very inconvenient and quite meddling for what needs to happen. One of the things we learn in chapter one is that Harry has really received no mail from any of his friends the entire summer. He's like, I thought I made pretty good friends at school. Why don't they want to talk to me? And as a 12-year-old, that makes you feel horrible.
And he,
because your mind immediately goes, why don't they like me?
Right. And he was supposed to go stay with Ron over the summer. That was the plan they made as they boarded the train.
However, we learn that the reason Harry has not been getting any of his mail is because Dobby has been stealing it.
And I love that Dobby just admits it, just like straight off the bat.
Yeah, because to Dobby's motivations are at their core for Harry's safety and Harry's best interest. Harry, Dobby is really meddling. However, he's knowing what we know now about Dobby that we don't necessarily find out yet. Dobby is risking so much to be able to make sure that Harry Potter is safe.
Dobby's really risking his life.
He's totally risking his life. Knowing what we know about Dobby, what we're going to find out, he's totally risking his life. But Harry doesn't know this, so Harry's just pissed.
Right, and it's come on the most inconvenient day ever, of course. It's written that way for a reason, obviously, but
yeah.
Downstairs, Vernon is trying to make the deal of a lifetime, and upstairs, Dobby's telling Harry he can't go back to Hogwarts, but he's not telling him why, and then Harry's getting frustrated, and then Dobby thinks he's doing something wrong, and his go-to response when he thinks he's doing something wrong is to bang his head on, like, the cupboard or the floor.
To make noise when Harry was supposed to be upstairs making no noise and pretending I don't exist.
Harry's like, can you stop banging your head all over the place? And so he says, Mr. Potter, tell Dobby that you will not go back to Hogwarts. And Harry's like, I hate it here. I literally cannot do that.
In a way, he can't. Like, the difference in his life and his circumstances between when he's at school and when he's at home with the Dursleys is drastic. And to Harry, if Dobby somehow was able to tell Harry exactly what was going to happen to him this year, I think Harry would still choose to go to school.
So when Harry can't commit to not going back to Hogwarts, Dobby's move is to run down the stairs and use a hover charm to hover the pudding that she made, thank you. And in the movies, the pudding just falls on Mrs. Mason's head.
Yes.
But in the book, it's a little worse. It falls on the floor, and then Harry's cleaning it up, and Vernon's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. It's our nephew. He's disturbed mentally. And it looks like they're going to be able to recover. But then a barn owl comes in, to drop a letter on Mrs. Mason's head, and she's terrified of birds. Mr. Mason is like, is this your sick idea of a joke? But how would the Dursleys know Mrs. Mason is terrified of birds? The letter tells the Dursleys that Harry is not supposed to have been using magic outside of school.
Because I think the Harry's got the trace on him, and somehow they don't register that the magic that is taking place with the pudding was not Harry's doing, but Dobby's doing. They just know that where Harry is residing, a hovering charm has taken place. House elf magic is a whole separate sort of facet of kinds of magic, and we can talk about that a little more maybe when we get to spew and stuff. The ministry does not register that this has not been done by Harry. They just know that a hovering charm has taken place, and they get sent, go ahead, they get sent, Harry gets sent a letter.
Yeah, so he gets sent a letter that says, we know this evening at 12 minutes past nine, there was a hovering charm used in your home, and as underage wizards are not permitted to perform spells outside of school. So there's a couple things here for me. Number one, the ministry is like the most inefficient government office ever. And that's a pretty tall order considering how inefficient American government is. But there are so many times in the subsequent books where the ministry definitely needed to be there and they were. So
yeah.
The fact that they could send this underage letter in literally under 5 minutes via owl to tell Harry to reprimand him is truly incredible to me.
Yeah.
The second thing is that this letter comes from Hopkirk.
Mother Hopkirk.
Who's going to reoccur in later books and in the movies as well.
I can just hear from the Order of the Phoenix film, hoping you are well, Mathilda Hopkirk.
Oh.
She seems to be the one in charge of sending the letters.
Yeah, so I'm just so impressed that the Ministry of Magic, which gets so few things right, was able to get this in under 5 minutes to Harry.
Now, the other problem with this letter, because Vernon has Harry read it out loud. The other problem with this letter is suddenly the Dursleys realize that they have been played. They have been played all summer.
Yeah.
They realize that Harry is not even allowed to do magic outside of school.
Do magic without his wand. Truly do magic without his wand, which they've taken away from him.
Yeah. But they've lived in fear, and Harry has known that they've been living in fear for months and has been enjoying it. And suddenly, just to add insult to injury, not only has he ruined the evening, according to Vernon, he has also been the cause of Vernon's conniption about getting cursed the whole summer.
And their response to this is so bad. This is probably the worst abuse they ever commit, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that is locking Harry in his room, putting bars on the window, and installing a cat flap door to push his food through.
And they don't even feed him a lot.
Yeah, they give him like a bowl of soup. And to me, I know that this is not a fun discussion in a fantasy book, but the amount of hatred somebody has to have for a human being, for a child, for your sister's child to starve them, it's so disgusting and just unbelievably disturbing to me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So it just gives me the heebie-jeebies.
It would give you the heebie-jeebies. Yeah. It gives me the heebie-jeebies.
So don't like that. But Harry is asleep.
Been a couple days because he's really hungry.
Right. And he opens his eyes and there is Ron Weasley outside of his window.
And Ron's two older brothers, Fred and George. So this brings us to chapter 3, mm-hmm. which is entitled The Burrow.
So Ron is in a flying car.
The Ford Anglia becomes one of my favorite new characters that we meet in this book because it really is a character.
And it's going to come back.
Oh yeah, in a big way. Yeah.
So Ron is in the car with none other than Fred and George Weasley.
If you need two people to help you do something completely illegal, who better to go to for help than Fred and George?
What I love about Fred and George is that all the things they do is with the best intention.
Friend George, like, pick the muggle lock on the bars of the window.
I love that. No, they go to the cupboard under the stairs and they
pull it's that lock.
They use the car to pull off the bars on the windows. Love that. And then Harry says, you have to be quiet because the Dursleys are sleeping. And they creep downstairs and they climb cat-like through the window into Harry's room. George took an ordinary hairpin from his pocket and started to pick the lock. So they pick the lock on Harry's door. Then they go downstairs and they pick the lock on the cupboard and they bring all of Harry's magical stuff out. And they load all that stuff into the Ford Anglia. And just as they're about to get away, Uncle Vernon coughs and wakes up. He hears Hedwig chirping. Do owls chirp?
Screeching.
Screeching.
Which is a horrible verb, but...
They hear Hedwig screeching, mm-hmm. and he wakes up, and that there he says, he's getting away!
But why does he hear Hedwig? They hear the screech, they hear Uncle Vernon's voice.
They get into the flying Ford Anglia, which has obviously been charmed with magic to fly, and they fly all the way to the burrow. But on their way, they have... Harry kind of fills them in on, oh, I wasn't getting your letters. There was a house elf in my bedroom. And Fred and George say, well, only really rich families have house elves. Like, and then, like the Malfoys.
Yes. So Harry basically, he has this idea. They say, oh, Dobby's probably from a rich wizarding family. Well, who's the richest, snobbiest wizard that Harry knows? Draco Malfoy. And Harry sort of has this thought off the cuff. He goes, honestly, it was probably a prank from Draco. Like, it could have just been a prank from Draco, and maybe Dobby is the Malfoy's house elf.
Right.
Little does he know, Dobby is the Malfoy's house elf.
Right. Yeah. It's so crazy. And then Ron says, well, I was getting really worried when you didn't answer any of my letters. I thought it was Errol's fault at first. And then we learn Errol, which we're going to see a lot in the future. Errol is like the worst owl ever. He's just old. And then they say something about Percy, which is really interesting. They said he's been acting very oddly this summer and has been sending a lot of letters and spending a lot of time shut up in his room. Which, Percy, the books do such a good job of explaining the whole Percy storyline. And that is something they just cut out in the whole movie series.
We hit Order of the Phoenix and we're like surprised to see him backing up Fudge. Or is it Order of the Phoenix? Or
no, it's Order of the Phoenix. Yeah, because he's there when they arrest Dumbledore.
Yeah,
we see Percy three main times. We see him at the Burrow when he's like a big jerk to everybody. We see him in Order of the Phoenix, and then he randomly shows up in the Battle of Hogwarts, and you're like, oh, you're on the right side of history again. Good job,
yeah.
Percy.
Yeah, he came to his senses. Yeah.
But they just never explain any of that in the movies. It drives me bananas. It's such a good storyline.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that they missed that we are now getting from the books again, which has been delightful.
Yes, very delightful. And so then Harry says, oh, wait, I didn't know your dad worked for the Ministry of Magic. And Ron says, yeah, he works in the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts office. LOL, because they're driving an enchanted Ford Anglia.
Yeah, so Arthur Weasley fixed up the car to be able to fly, but it's really against ministry code to own a flying vehicle that's not like registered through them or like not one of the already approved code vehicles. So the fact that he has this car is a little bit on the hush, which is why Molly Weasley is so extra pissed that the boys took the car in the middle of the night and left without a note. Because she's like, if they found out about your father's car, he'd be in huge trouble at the ministry. Not to mention you snuck out, not to mention you kidnapped somebody.
So they fly to the Burrow, which is the home of the Weasleys, which George tells us we're a little outside the village, Ottery St. Catchpole. So that is the town in which the Weasleys live. It's also the town which the Lovegoods live, and supposedly the Diggorys also live.
Oh, that's right.
So,
right. Ottery St. Catchpole is not a real place, but it was based on a town called Ottery St. Mary. That's it.
So they touch down outside of the burrow. They think they're sneaking in. There's Mrs. Weasley marching across the yard. I love her line, bed's empty, no note, car gone.
And this is another example. Yeah, this is another example of, if you remember from the film, we discussed in our episode about the Sorcerer's Stone film, the dialogue was taken pretty literally out of the book. Mm-hmm. The same goes for Chamber of Secrets. Until Prisoner of Azkaban, the dialogue was pretty directly transcribed from the book. And this is one of those sort of iconic lines. They come inside and Harry's looking at the spoons on the clock and she says that line.
He goes into the burrow and he thinks it's the most wonderful place he had ever seen. He's never been to a wizard house before. And I have to imagine, I mean, we get the visual in the movie, but everything is enchanted and the clock, instead of numbers, it says time to feed the chickens, you're late, charm your own cheese, enchantment and baking. Like, it's so, those are the books on the mantelpiece. He hears the witch radio for the first time. Like
Celestina Warbeck.
Yeah, it's so awesome.
It would shut the door on a lot of opportunities for the story if Harry experienced every possible facet of the magical world, all in Sorcerer's Stone, all in the first book of the series. But there are moments in the rest of the books where he continues to get to experience new things in the wizarding world. And one of those is, what does a wizarding household look like? How does it function? And the burrow could not be more delightful to him, because not only is it super cool that he gets to see all these magical things and like how wizards do certain tasks versus how muggles do certain tasks, but there's just, I don't think Harry's ever been in a house probably that just feels so family oriented and full of love and care for one another. I think he really gets that sense right off the bat.
Yeah, it's just a complete 180 from what he's been in what he's been living at the Dursleys. And Mrs. Weasley's mad at all of the other, she's mad at Ron, she's mad at Fred and George. But to Harry, she's like, oh, welcome, Harry. I'm so happy you're here. We were saying we were just going to come get you ourselves if we hadn't heard from you. I feel so happy for Harry. It was like the first time I walked into the theater office house.
And Julie Walters, who plays Molly Weasley in the film, does a really great job with the complete shift between speaking to Ron and then speaking to Harry. She looks really menacing, like she's going to punish him for a month. And then she turns to Harry and she's like saccharine sweet. And it's really brilliant. Yeah, it's really brilliant how she played that. And then instead of getting to go to bed, the boys get a chore immediately. And Harry joins in. They are doing what? They're denoming the garden.
Which I love. And this is the first time we're going to hear about Gilderoy Lockhart. So they handle the gnomes. They go back into the kitchen. And Mr. Weasley's, it says he was a thin man, going bald, but the little hair he had was as red as any of his children's. He was wearing long green robes, which were dusty and travel worn. So he's just come back from raids. And he says, old Madungus Fletcher tried to put a hex on me.
The ministry has been raiding households for dark magic objects. This is going to pop up in, I believe, the next chapter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we just need to know that the ministry is conducting raids. They're still cleaning up the aftermath of the first wizarding war. They're like trying to get rid of dark magic and what have you.
And they talk a little bit about muggle baiting, which is really interesting. They said, the cell muggles a key that keeps shrinking to nothing so they can never find it when they need it. And of course, it's very hard to convince anyone because no muggle would admit their keys keep shrinking. They'll just insist they keep losing it. Bless them, they'll go to any lengths to ignore magic, even if it's staring them in the face. But the things are a lot of taken to enchanting, you wouldn't believe.
And one of the things we need to know about Arthur Weasley, about his character, is that the Weasley family is, and in fact, the Pruitt family, where Molly comes from before she was married into the Weasley family, both of those families are part of the Sacred 28. There was a book published, they think, by a member of the Knott family in the 1930s that described the wizarding families in Britain that were still purely, completely purebloods. Mm-hmm. Because you can be the son or daughter of two wizards, but if your mother was muggle born, and then like they sort of consider that not completely pure blood, like any of it matters. But so the Weasleys are a part of the Sacred 28. But what's so delightful about the Weasleys is And my mom has said before when we've been watching the films, they go, the Weasleys are Democrats. The Weasleys have none of the prejudices or sort of tropes of any of those other pureblood families. Arthur Weasley loves and is completely fascinated by Muggles. He doesn't see them as below or less than whatsoever.
Molly rips into him about the car. And he tells her, well, I think you would find that it's quite within the law to do that. There's a loophole. And she's like, of course there's a loophole, Arthur. You wrote the law. And she says, Harry arrived this morning in the car you weren't intending to fly. And he says, Harry who? And he looks around and he jumps. And he's like, oh, good Lord, is it Harry Potter? And it's so funny because, I don't know, it's just so funny to know that Harry is still famous to some people.
Yeah.
Even the Weasleys, which are his best friend's parents, like, they're still infatuated with the
totally
fact that this is Harry.
But also what's even funnier is I think they're all sitting around the table at this point, are they? Mm-hmm. Or has he just come in? Anyway, Harry's there and all of the Weasleys have red hair. Harry has jet black hair, but Arthur has not registered that he's even in the house at all because he's just used to like so many children having so many kids around that he like has not registered that Harry's even there yet.
And of course, Ginny's there as well.
Molly's mad that they took the car. And at first, Arthur is incredibly impressed. He's like, wow, did it work? How was she? Just to end the chapter three, he sees Harry sort of have a little bit of a visceral reaction to his room. And Ron immediately goes to the place where he thinks Harry is judging him or thinking this is like for poor people. And so Ron cuts off his train of thought, or where he thinks his train of thought is going, and starts qualifying those thoughts that he thinks Harry might be having. He says, it's a bit small, Ron, said Ron quickly, not like the room you had with the Muggles, and I'm right underneath the ghoul in the attic, which is funny. I'm right underneath the ghoul in the attic. He's always banging on the pipes and groaning, but Harry, grinning widely, says, this is the best house I've ever been in.
It's time to go get all their school books for the second year, or for the rest of the Weasley children, not their second year. I love that they're meeting Hermione's parents in Diagon Alley. I think that's
yeah.
Really cute.
Yeah.
I don't think we want to get too caught up on plot stuff, but
yeah,
this is Harry's first time hearing about flu powder.
Yes. So we should note that there are many modes of transportation in the wizarding world. I would say the most widely used one is apparition. Mm-hmm. However, you can't apparate before you're 17, and you have to have a license to apparate because it can be really dangerous. You can end up splinching yourself, which is like leaving a part of your body elsewhere and not taking it with you. So, and there are ways you can apparate with minors called a side-along apparition where you like do it for them if they're holding on to you. But most, I'd say most probably families like the Weasleys are connected to the flu network via their house because there's less room for error with travel by the flu network.
Right, and to apparate with seven children, you'd have to like apparate one, go back, get the other one, go back. So yeah, so kind of like Muggles would take a driving test, or like we took a driving test. There's a whole office of the ministry dedicated to handling apparition testing for minor wizards, which is so interesting. But then mm-hmm. you could also fly by broomstick, not really the most convenient mode of transportation, or you could do port keys.
And we will talk all about that in Goblet of Fire.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is Harry's first experience, or even the first time he's ever heard of the flu network. Molly keeps her flu powder in a flower pot. And all of the kids line up and they tell him you have to speak clearly so you get to the right destination. And Harry says Diagon Alley, but he doesn't really.
But I think we need to note there's a reason for this. So Harry has never experienced flu powder. The concept behind using the flu network is you take a handful of this powder, you throw it into a fireplace, which erupts in green flames, but you can't feel the flames, don't hurt you. They don't damage you in any way. But imagine like you never having heard about this and watching somebody walk into a fireplace that is on fire and then disappearing into thin air. Like
so
that
wild.
Would, yeah, I'd crap my pants. Like that's terrifying.
Very scary.
So Harry in his terror to get this right, even though his one instruction is to speak clearly, he does not speak clearly.
No, he says
diagonally. Coughs and stutters.
And he ends up and Nocturne Alley,
which is like Diagon Alley's like weird twin sister.
And who does he see?
His favorite person.
His arch nemesis, Draco Malfoy.
Yep.
So he spots a large black cabinet and he gets inside of it. And when I'm reading this, my first thought is like, oh God, I hope that's not a vanishing cabinet.
Is it not?
I think it is the vanishing
cabinet. I think it's the vanishing cabinet, yeah.
But he just doesn't vanish, so that's...
Well, you have to do a spell.
Right.
Right. Not only does Draco walk into the shop, we get to meet one of my favorite villains in the series.
Oh, he's so good.
Lucius Malfoy.
The man who followed could only be Draco's father. He had the same pale, pointed face and identical cold gray eyes. And he says to Draco, touch nothing.
I like love to hate Lucius Malfoy, but like, I don't even hate him. Like I know he's bad and I don't like him necessarily, but I love to not like him. Like he's you know what I mean?
A good character.
Yeah.
I love that Draco's, you told me you were going to buy me a present. Such a Dudley line.
Draco is the like preppy wizarding version of Dudley.
Do you think Draco's preppy?
Yes. Nope. Is that up for debate? Maybe this is me just thinking of the films. Doesn't Draco like take great pride in his appearance and dress really well? His appearance is an outward demonstration of his wealth, which he takes great pride in. So yeah, I would think Draco's preppy.
He turns to wearing those black suits.
Yeah. Is that book material or is that just a film?
I don't know. We're going to have to examine Draco's preppiness as we go. But yeah, I would say Draco has preppy style. Like to me, preppy is seersucker shorts and Sperry shoes.
Oh my God, does Draco wear Vineyard Vines?
Brooks Brothers?
Anyway.
I like to think of a version of Draco that does dress like that.
I'm going to have to go on like a fan art hunt.
But
I'm sure it exists.
Draco is more of a like old world, fancy, aristocratic British family way of dressing.
Could we not akin that to preppy?
I don't know.
Like, is Draco like goth chic? What do you?
Yeah, I would say the Malfoys are like goth chic.
Goth chic is a good description.
I wouldn't say preppy. None of them own seersucker.
That's why that's your version of preppy.
That is preppy style. It's Ivy League fraternity. That's preppy style. Ralph Lauren, J. Crew. I think the Malfoys are more of like a Valentino Gucci family.
Oh, so like. Designer. Okay. I love that one.
Lucius Malfoy says, I told you I would buy you a racing broom. And then Malfoy goes into this diatribe about how Harry got special permission from Dumbledore to play for the Gryffindor Quidditch team, and he's not even that good. It's just because he's famous for having a stupid scar on his forehead. And then Lucius says something that I think is so interesting. He says, I would remind you that it is not prudent to appear less than fond of Harry Potter. Not when most of our kind regard him as the hero who made the Dark Lord disappear. I think that's so interesting.
It's very interesting because, as we will find out, Lucius was, he was a Death Eater during the First Wizarding War. He wasn't as, like, outward in his, not necessarily in his support, but in his, like, field work for the Dark Lord. He was more Lucius is a politician. Lucius is fully a politician. The way he supports the cause is by gaining support from the people on the inside, on the harvesting seeds on what we assume to be the side of good. We like look to the Ministry of Magic to be the people that are actively opposing the Dark Lord. That might not be the case because Lucius has a lot of friends on the inside of that institution. And so at the end of the day, his brand of supporting the cause is politically. And politically, it's not good for Draco to be making statements that. I don't think Lucius was particularly fine. I think he overlapped with James Potter and Lily in school, but like a couple years above at least. I don't think he was particularly fond of the Potters. But because of Harry's standing in the wizarding world, it's not great for Draco to be saying stuff like that. And Lucius knows that politically.
Right. I think you're right about Malfoy, the elder Malfoy, Lucius, being very political. I think he'll go to whatever keeps his status safe in the world. Mm-hmm. He obviously cares a lot about blood status and his family being considered prominent. We're going to see this a lot. Both Lucius and Arthur work for the Ministry of Magic, but Lucius holds a very different kind of position and is very friendly with the minister. We see it in Goblet of Fire when he gets better box seats for the Quidditch World Cup than the Weasleys.
Well, and the differences between Lucius, and that's another dichotomy I love in the series, is like the differences between Lucius's character and Arthur's character, not only like their status in the world, but how they treat people, because I think their status has to do with how they treat people. Lucius, I mean, he already is considered to be of high status because he's very wealthy, but I think he's sort of self-important and he has a very high opinion of himself. I think he probably manipulates and is conniving, and that's how he's climbed his way to the top, whereas Arthur has a pure heart and is a good person. And that has probably allowed him to be passed over when it comes to their career paths.
Right. Arthur loves his job working for the Office of Muggle Artifacts. And Lucius sees that as like a scar on the face of wizardry. How could you want to work there?
Yeah.
Like, that's just...
And that leads to a moment that I sincerely wish they had put in the film. Oh, let's get there in a second. Anyway, Harry's in Morgan and Burke's. He's trapped in the Vanishing Cabinet. The Malfoys are in there, and he overhears Lucius talking to Mr. Burke. Mr. Morgan. Mr. Burke is not there. Mr. Morgan. And he is just bringing in some wares. And the reason he is bringing in some wares, he says, I don't want you to sell these. I just want you to keep them for me because the ministry has been snooping. So Malfoy suspects that though he has a lot of friends in high places, he might be targeted by one of these raids. I don't think they would bust down the door of Malfoy Manor. They'd probably knock very nicely and just say, could we just take a peek around? But he suspects that some people are just going to come snooping. And he has some things in his house that he does not really want them finding. Harry hears a very important piece of information that he keeps the things that he doesn't want anybody finding in his house in a chamber under the dining room or something. Do all the like prominent Slytherin families have a chamber, like a secret chamber in their house? Is that like a thing?
Yeah.
McKenna, does the Velasquez family have a secret? You have a kitten chamber.
Is that your chamber?
Yeah, there's a kitten. McKenna fosters kittens.
Yeah.
There's a kitten chamber in the house. I like that secret chamber. Anyway, so Harry finds out the location of the like kind of sketchy things that Malfoy would just rather not be seen as owning. And then Harry eventually finds an opportune moment when the Malfoys leave to sneak out of the store. Thank God for Rubius Hagrid, who comes to his rescue.
Yet again.
And fishes him out of the alley. Hagrid was there buying flesh-eating slug repellent because they've been tearing up the cabbages. And that's another reason Hagrid's so sweet, is he just like is caring for the school's crops. It's adorable.
There are keys and grounds.
Yeah, but what's so cute is Hagrid says, I was really bummed that you didn't write me over the summer. You didn't answer any of my letters. He was probably so sad sitting in his little hut and he hadn't heard from Harry.
I know. And so he brings him back to Diagon Alley. He sees the familiar.
Which is luckily right next door.
He sees Gringotts Bank. He then sees Hermione and the Weasleys, and she's catching up with everybody. One of the things I think is so cute is Mr. Weasley is so excited to meet the Grangers.
Oh, yeah.
And help them convert their muggle money into wizarding money so they can buy all of her school supplies.
Yes.
And he keeps insisting that they go have a drink with him at the Leaky Cauldron.
He just wants to ask them all the questions, probably. And it's Molly's so like, do not overwhelm them. Leave them alone. It is adorable. And whenever I'm sad, I just think if Arthur Weasley met me, he would probably be so excited to make my acquaintance. You know, and that's a comforting thought.
It is a comforting thought. And Harry tells Mr. Weasley all about the interaction he's just seen with Malfoy and at Morgan and Burke's. And, you know, Mr. Weasley is really intrigued. He says, did Lucius buy anything? And Harry says he was selling. And Mr. Weasley has satisfaction. He's like, oh, I would love to get Lucius Malfoy for something. And Molly's like, don't go biting off more than you can chew. And he's like, what? You don't think I'm a match for Lucius Malfoy?
And that probably does not help the interaction that's about to happen between them.
Yeah. I love
So then
Arthur.
Where do they all go next? I love Arthur too. Where do they go next?
Do they go to Flourish and Blotts? If I could go to any store on Diagon Alley, I think I would be most excited to go to Flourish and Blotts and just look at all the magical books.
Yeah, I agree.
Because magical books, like fantasy, is fiction to us. So I wonder what fiction to wizards and witches would be.
Apparently Martin the Mad Muggle.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. We learn that Gilderoy Lockhart, who Molly has referenced in the previous chapter, is going to be signing copies of his autobiography, Magical Me.
Oh, Lord. What's the actor's name? What is the actor's name who plays him in the films?
So perfect.
He's so good. He does such a great job. Let me find his name. It's really going to bother me. Played by Kenneth Branagh. Duh. I think just does a fantastic job with Gilderoy Lockhart in the films. However, in the book, again, we get so much more Gilderoy Lockhart content just because time in the films wouldn't allow. And he is just, God, if he's just so much more aggravating in the book than he is even in the films. Every opportunity, we all know one of those people where every opportunity they get to talk about themselves, they take. And it's just awful.
Yeah, it's horrible. Lockhart spots Harry in the crowd and is like, oh, when Mr. Potter walked in here today, he didn't think that he was going to be able to be on the front page of the Daily Prophet with me, Gilderoy Lockhart, and then walking away with signed copies of every single one of my books. Harry is just so embarrassed by this entire interaction. And then what I think is so sweet is he tips the books into Ginny's cauldron and says, you have these all by my own, obviously knowing that he has a whole vault of money at Gringotts.
And previously at the Burrow, the Weasleys, the friend George had said, Mom, how are we going to afford this? And Molly goes, we'll manage, it'll be fine.
When they went to the bank to get their money out, Harry tried to hide as he was putting money in his like sack or whatever they carry their money in. It's just such a bummer. The Weasleys obviously have so many children. And I do think it's so interesting how conscious Harry is of never making them.
And that's actually, I found that to be a criticism among the fandom a little bit. If Harry knew that Ron didn't have a lot of money, why didn't he just buy all of his stuff for him? I think Harry finds his own ways to support Ron and the rest of the Weasleys financially as best as he can. First of all, he's a child.
Right.
And even he's generous and he's kind, but even as a 12-year-old, he's like, how can I possibly help? And he finds his own ways to help. I don't think Arthur and Molly would accept just like flat out charity from Harry. Yeah, I don't think they would accept that. A, because he's a child and they're like, you don't know what you're doing. And B, because they're like, we can manage, we can do this. They take pride in their ability to navigate being in their socioeconomic level that they're in. Yeah. So anyway, he gives Ginny the books. Draco and Lucius show up. And then the scene we all wish was in the movie. Lucius and Arthur get in a fist fight in public.
I know.
Everything.
I do wish they had put the fist fight in the movies. It's so epic.
It's epic. And it's just like, what a guy, Arthur Weasley. Just like so ready to, like Lucius is probably his superior at work, not in his department necessarily, but has a higher position than he does. He's so ready to just like stick it to him. He just does. So great. Would you like to know a couple facts about Gilderoy Lockhart?
Oh boy, what a...
So another thing we learn in while Harry's in Flourish and Blotts is Lockhart announces that he has been hired as the Defense Against the Dark Arts professor at Hogwarts this year. That's like his big announcement and why he was coming out and signing books that day, knowing that all the students would be there to get their books. So a couple facts about Lockhart. He started at Hogwarts in 1975. He was 4 years under the Marauders and Lily, so he would have known them at school. He was sorted into Ravenclaw, which is funny. I love that in every house there's a character that is like unexpectedly part of that house. So like in Gryffindor, Peter Pettigrew doesn't really display sort of normal Gryffindor qualities on the surface. In Hufflepuff, you know, Cedric Diggory is seen as being really more displaying more bravery than maybe how people view Hufflepuffs stereotypically. Gilderoy Lockhart is like the like divergent Ravenclaw, but not really. Because Ravenclaws are known for valuing wit and learning, but Lockhart, while maybe he's not super skilled at magic, he is really skilled at manipulation and very smart about how he can turn other people's successes into his own. That takes a lot of brains to figure that out. It's not good. It's certainly very deceitful. But yeah, so he's a Ravenclaw. He also invented a line of hair care products that were made out of alchemy egg yolk, but they were too dangerous and expensive to put on the market. So those are some fun facts about Lockhart.
I love those fun facts about Lockhart.
Thank okay, you. Chapter 5, iconic. Yeah. Iconic.
I don't know if there's anything really deep to say here, but
it's more just action.
In the charmed Ford Anglia, I love that Molly looks back and she's like, wow, this is deceivingly big, when all of the kids are smushed in the back.
They're at the they're going from the borough to King's Cross.
Right.
To go to school that day.
It's just so funny that she didn't pick up that it is magically.
Yeah, there's no magical extension charm on the car, so it can fit the whole family.
So funny. And then they get to the King's Cross station. Everybody goes before them to get into platform 9 1/4.
Before Harry and Ron, yeah.
And then Harry and Ron are trying to go through the, I don't know if portal is the right word. The platform.
Yeah.
The portal to the platform.
Correct.
And they can't.
They crash in a pile of books and trunks and Hedwig's cage.
And all the
if they had just waited for Mr. and Mrs. Weasley to come back through, they probably could have gotten a letter to Dumbledore, figured something out. But no, the boys jump to conclusions. And what's their best idea? We're 12. Let's steal the freaking car and drive ourselves.
Just the minds of 12-year-old boys. They think they're going to make this like smooth entrance on the lawn. Everybody's going to run out and be like, oh my God, you flew a car to school. Yeah. And that like they're going to make it there.
They're fantasizing about how great that's going
to
be.
Change into their robes and go to the sorting ceremony. And everything's going to be totally cool. And of course, they get there and they crash into the Whomping Willow. It just thrashes them around like no other.
They just get battered and the car gets destroyed. Yeah.
So then they get basically like spit out of the tree and they...
A very important thing happens before they just walk into the Great Hall. They get spit out of the car. They escape the willow. The car touches down. It spits them out, spits all of their luggage out, somehow develops a mind of its own, and then runs off into the Forbidden Forest. They're trying to sneak in unannounced and sort
Snape
of...
Snape catches them.
Of course he does. Of course it's Snape.
Yeah, of course it is. And he brings them to, is it his office?
Yes.
Or the teacher's lounge?
I think it's his office. And he says, or is it, you're right, it might be the staff room. I believe it's his office. I will look.
But he essentially says that, oh, if you were in my house, I would expel you. But lucky for you, it's not up to me.
They go to Snape's office.
And then Dumbledore and McGonagall walk in. And McGonagall, like... of course, gives them a free pass, but they have to do detention.
That's not a free pass. It would take a lot for a student to get expelled from Hogwarts. Yeah, and sure. This is a pretty serious offense, but Snape has a bias against Harry and against Ron, and his reaction to this would be to expel them. I think that's a little bit influenced by how he feels about them personally. So I don't think that would warrant getting an expulsion. But yeah, it is a pretty grave offense. So McGonagall gives them detention for a pretty long period of time.
And then that's really it. I love that she brings them food.
Yes, because they've missed the feast.
Which is so sweet. And then they join the others in the common room. And Hermione, of course, is just disgusted that they did what they did, but everybody else thinks it's so cool. And so they go to bed feeling pretty pleased with themselves.
Yeah.
To be 12 again.
So good. So good. I just love the Ford Anglia. I can't wait for it to come back. Anyway.
So that was our discussion on Chamber of Secrets, chapters 1-5. Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.